Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And welcome back to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And it is the end of hashtag Asian August. If you have been living under a rock, it's been, I guess, the biggest month for Asian American representation in the movie theaters. We had like a gajillion movies come out.
It was an avalanche of movies.
From Darkest Minds to Crazy Rich Asians to this weekend, Searching opens wide, which is a great thriller starring John Cho. Rira and I have both watched it.
Yeah, and our fellow Potluck podcast, they call us Bruce, they interviewed John Cho.
Yeah, they had a great interview with John Cho. You should check it out on They Call Us Bruce. You can find out more about that by going to podcastpotluck.com and clicking on They Call Us Bruce. But we are not here to talk about movies. Or are we?
Or are we?
It's the end of the month, so that means we'll be discussing our August book club pick, which happens to be Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan, the book that was turned into the hit Hollywood movie that is going to its third week, and chances are good that it's going to be the number one movie 3 weeks in a row.
Yeah, yeah.
Granted, it's August, so it's always been kind of a dead month for movies, but it's...
We just took over. Yeah. I mean, we took advantage of
we
it.
We might as well. There was an opening. There was a
it's the number eight. I mean, yeah. You're just asking for it on a silver platter.
Like, they had this month that they weren't using. We said, well, we'll take it and we'll make $1 billion in it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But before we get to our book club discussion, I wanted to quickly go over some recent book news. Rira has compiled a list of new publishing news over the month of August. And since we haven't gone over book news in a while, I wanted to quickly get this out of the way before we get into our book club discussion. So, Rira, why don't you start us off with the first story?
All right. Our first story is Paul Wiseman Books bought world rights to Taewon Yoo's picture book, The Garden Book. Set in South Korea, the book explores the relationship between a grandfather, grandchild, and their garden, where all living things flourish with love and attention. Publication is slated for 2021.
It sounds like it's going to be beautiful.
There's a lot of picture books in this list of book deals, by the way. Just heads up.
It's a new trend, Asian American picture books. In a four-book deal, Scholastic bought Christina Soontorvat's fantasy chapter book series, Diary of an Ice Princess, in which a young princess, Windtamer, must keep her royal status and her power to control the weather, secret from her human classmates. Publication for the first two books in the series is scheduled for summer 2019.
Sounds like Frozen. And also Storm from X-Men.
And Avatar.
So the many
Last Airbender.
I'm all for it, by the way. Those are all things that I think would make a great picture book. Or I guess it's not a picture book. Middle grade series. Christina Soontorvat also sold her middle grade nonfiction title, All 13, The Incredible Cave Rescue of the Thai Boys Soccer Team. The book draws on Soontorvat's knowledge of Thailand and her expertise in key STEM topics that impacted the crisis and rescue. Publication is scheduled for 2020.
Cool. One of many projects that are going to feature that story. Next up, Levine Books at Scholastic bought world rights to John Lau's debut picture book about the limitless possibilities of a child's imagination, following a girl and her unicorn as she makes her own path when others tell her no. Publication is set for 2020.
Levine Books also bought Sarah Jung's debut picture book, When Father Comes Home, which is about June's relationship with his father, who, like a goose, flies abroad for long stretches of time. The story is based on the term goose dad, a term that describes Korean fathers who live and work in South Korea in order for their children to receive education in an English-speaking country. Publication is slated for 2021.
So is that like reverse parachute kid?
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up with a lot of classmates who had dads working in South Korea while like they were going to like high school here.
Oh.
It's a very common thing.
Mm. Salam Reads bought world rights to Syra Mir's debut picture book, Muslim Girls Rise. This collection of short biographies introduces young readers to the 19th to 21st century Muslim women whose inspirational work are changing the world. This book will be illustrated by Aliyah Jalil. Publication is planned for 2020.
Clarion Books bought Sadia Faruqi and Laura Chauvin's dual narrative contemporary middle grade novel, A Place at the Table. The book features Pakistani-American Sarah Hamid and a mixed-race British named Elizabeth Shanemark, who meet in a South Asian cooking club and discover that both of their mothers are applying for U.S. citizenship. Publication is scheduled for spring 2020.
Capstone acquired Bao Fi's second picture book, My Footprints, which will be illustrated by Basia Tran. The story centers on Tui, a Vietnamese-American girl with two mothers who was bullied for being different. On the wintry walk home from school, Tui imagines how various animals might react to being bullied, gaining comfort and courage as she makes each animal's footprints in the snow.
Next story is Little B bought Katrina Moore's picture book, Grandpa Grumps, which follows Daisy as she meets her Chinese grandfather for the first time and learns to connect with him across cultures and generations. Cindy Yan will be illustrating the book, and publication is slated for spring 2020.
Aw, sounds cute. Next up, Two Lines and Amazon acquired husband and wife team Anna Kang and Christopher Wayant's picture book, Hudson and Tallulah, which is about next-door neighbors with opposite worldviews who discover some common ground.
And our final story, or I guess final book deal, Razorbill bought Andrea Tang's YA debut novel, Rebel Wing, set in near-future North America divided by culture wars. Her story follows a scholarship student at a prestigious prep school who smuggles black market media. Her life changes drastically when a sentient cybernetic dragon imprints on her as its pilot, forcing her to the forefront of a revolution. Publication is slated for spring 2020. Man, this book sounds awesome.
That sounds anime AF.
Oh my god. All the anime books. Sounds like Evangelion.
Or like Escaflowne.
Escaflowne, man. Brings me back.
And those are the top publishing stories in Asian and Asian American literature. As always, if we did miss any deals that's on your radar, please let us know on Goodreads, and we'll make sure to shout them out in a future episode.
Before we move on to our book discussion, I would like to extend congratulations to Jenny Han. Her book, To All the Boys I Loved Before, is back on number one on the New York Times bestsellers list.
Oh, yeah.
For children's books, I think.
I think that
it beat Harry Potter, by the way.
Really?
Harry Potter is number two.
I mean, Harry Potter is also a really old book.
I know, but still. it's an accomplishment.
I feel like Crazy Rich Asians did the same thing right before its release,
yes,
too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's good that movies are encouraging people to read again.
Or discouraging them to read. How many people have we met who said, like, oh, I watched a movie, so I don't have to read the book?
Well, I mean, I say that about Harry Potter, but because there's so many Harry Potter books. I don't have time. I'm busy reading Crazy Rich Asians.
How many times have you talked about Crazy Rich Asians, the movie, on separate podcasts?
A lot.
A lot,
a lot,
right?
Of times, yeah.
But this is the first one where you're going to be talking about the book.
Right, because I just finished the book. So before I had no context. Now I have context. So be prepared. This is the most nuanced conversation on Crazy Rich Asians that I will have on a podcast.
Or just like in general. I feel like everyone's talking about the movie.
There was a pretty good discussion on another podcast I listened to called Pop Rocket, where there was their summer book club pick. So they talked a lot about the book. I have a feeling we're going to be talking about different things, though.
Probably.
Yeah, because we are an Asian-American book club, so we have, you know, a very unique perspective on these things.
We also have thoughts.
Yeah.
Lots of thoughts.
So this is your official warning. We're about to get into the spicy and juicy deets of Crazy Rich Asians. That means spoilers will be upcoming. So if you haven't read the book, go read the book and then come back and listen. Or if you don't care, just keep listening. It's fine. But
as always, we're going to start with the jacket description.
Yeah, so we get started. When New Yorker Rachel Chu agrees on a summer in Singapore to visit her boyfriend's traditional Chinese family, she expects the trip to be relaxing, if a little dull. She has no idea. .. Nick's childhood home is a palace. He grew up riding in more private planes than cars. He and Rachel will be attending the wedding of the year. Oh, and Nick just happens to be one of Asia's most eligible bachelors. And his formidable mother isn't so sure Rachel is the right one for him. Dun, dun, dun.
So, this was my second time reading Crazy Rich Asians. The first time I read it was back when it first came out in hardcover.
That was like 2013?
2012, I think. Okay. I think it was 2012.
No, I have the book. Let me check. This book has such thin pages.
It's because there's a lot of pages. It's a pretty long book.
I kept like skipping pages when I'm flipping the page. Originally published in 2013.
Oh, 2013. Yeah. Maybe that's the paperback copyright. I'm not sure.
Maybe.
But it's close enough. 2012, 2013, whatever. And this was my second time reading it, and I have read it like after the movie had come out.
Okay.
And I've watched a movie 3 times so far. Not the 5-time membership of a lot of our friends right now.
I've watched it 7 times.
You've watched it 7 times.
Yes.
That's okay. Wow. And
I only paid for 2, though, to be fair.
I mean, you watched it more than once. I think you've contributed to the box office sales. But Marvin, this was your first time reading the book, and you watched a movie before.
Yes. I finally read a book of a movie I watched. I think Lauren Lola was giving me tons of crap on the forums.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was like,
shots fired.
I'm curious to see how the book differs from the movie. And she was like, no, how the movie differs from the book. Chicken and egg, clearly defined.
So what were your expectations since you watched the movie first?
Well, okay, so I hadn't read the book till recently, but I had heard of people reading the book. And I knew that in terms of the people in the Asian American arts community that I hang out with, there was mixed feelings. A lot of people loved it. A lot of people didn't love it. But overall, I knew that I had a good idea of what the strengths and weaknesses of the prose was going to be. Because a lot of people explained it to me. It's like it's very extravagant, a lot of name dropping. But inside of that, there's a pretty, like, it's a breezy summer, juicy read. So that was my mindset going in, because I really love the film, as people who have listened to me on other podcasts know that it hit at me in a way that no other movie has in a very long time. And I mean, I watched it 7 times, but I was into it all 7 times, which is, you know, something that not a lot of movies do to me.
For me, when I read this, when it came out in hardcover, I remember the excitement over it. I remember so many people were just like, finally, we get like our own romance novel, because that's what people have been pitching it to me as. It's a romance novel.
Is it a romance novel?
It's a romance novel. It's a beach novel. Like, it's not meant to be taken like super seriously. You're supposed to have fun with it. And for me, I went into it thinking that, you know, it wasn't going to represent me, obviously, because I'm not rich. I'm not Singaporean. I'm not Chinese. I'm not Taiwanese. Like, I'm not any of those things. So I went in with pretty much no expectation of myself being represented. Mm-hmm. I think that really worked out, because a lot of the anger that was targeted at Crazy Rich Asians was the, I guess, lack of representation for specific Asian groups, because it was like the first of its kind, really, because it was like the first book where you have an Asian American character going to Asia.
Right.
It's very, very, it was very rare back then to see an Asian male love interest, and to see just kind of like the nuanced differences between like Asian Americans and,
yeah, I mean,
like Asian overseas.
I mean, I wasn't super, like, back then we were still pushing, like, I was in collaboration at the time. We were pushing a lot of indie films that, like, featured Asian Americans, but I wasn't that aware of what was going on in books, because I think even, like, Own Voices style of, like, stories has, it's only recently that's been, like, a big push for it, right?
Yeah, and it's still very behind because I feel like YA and middle grade, like children's publishing, they are much, much more ahead than mm-hmm. like literary fiction and what you would call adult fiction. Right. I feel like you can read whatever you want, but I do remember the excitement over it. I do remember people being really excited about it, and I remember people even back then saying like this would make a great movie. And I remember reading it thinking like this is a K-drama, like the ridiculousness of it all, like it would translate so well onto screen.
Yeah, I remember my friend Mindy Chang, who's my co-host for the Clubcast, she read the book way before I did, like maybe a year or two ago, before the movie came out, when she learned about how it's going to become a movie. I think it was when they're doing the open casting call. Right. Mm-hmm. And I remember her like saying that it's too descriptive, and she can see like this would all play better as a movie.
Yeah. Cause like one of the weaknesses of the book is how there is so much name dropping because there's like so many fashion brands.
Yeah.
And it's like I understand that.
I learned what couture means finally.
I understand that.
He was giving me the worst.
Yeah,
look
like right so, now. So much shade at you. I understand that rich people are really into fashion, or at least like that top 0.1% of really rich Asians. They're really into fashion, but in a movie, you can just look at a dress and be like, "Oh, okay, it's
that looks fashion."
That looks right? fashion. Yeah. Whereas, like in the book, it's like, why am I reading a page of just like what this person is wearing?
How many cars they have in their garage, what type of flooring they have, what type of like it was very extravagant and decadent, but I found myself skipping those parts after a while.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I get it. They have a bunch of cars that are really nice.
I mean, if you read this book as a satire, like you can validate the excessive materialistic prose by saying like, oh, this is just like how rich people think, and it's really annoying,
I guess. Yeah.
But like I think it's really open to interpretation. I mean, like for me personally, I was just really annoyed about
I thought it was funny that like it all like it at once glorified and also made fun of brands. Like it name drops all these fancy brands, but it talks crap about like Chanel and Dior's, and we're like the
Louis Vuitton,
yeah, and like the touristy brands, the ones that like the mainlanders want. And I don't know, I feel like Kevin Kwan's a thing against mainlanders for some reason. I get the distinct feeling. I don't know.
I know Kevin Kwan, like he's Singaporean, and he comes from a very old money family. Like his grandfather was like one of the first Western trained specialist. I don't remember which specialty he practiced in, but like
he was like a fancy doctor.
Yeah, he was like the first Western trained Singaporean doctor of that field. Yeah. I just can't remember what field it was, but like he comes from a very old money Singaporean family, and he grew up around other old money Singaporean families. So a lot of his knowledge is injected into the book, and you can really tell that he knows his stuff. But at the same time, like it was just kind of like,
I so want to just have this discussion, be comparing the movie to the book, but I'm gonna like let's not think about the movie for a while because there's a lot to say.
Yeah, we can probably talk about it more towards like the middle of the podcast, but like I do want to get through some of the plot points in the book first.
Yeah. I guess my last thoughts on just how the book was written was I found myself not being a fan of the prose. And I say that's being not entirely sure what that phrase means 100%, but just the way that it's written, like, I don't know. There's something that just I found wanting in the way he describes things and the way he writes dialogue. And I felt like I got the story and I got the gist of things, but I think the dialogue especially, like, it's not how people talk to each other. A lot of times I feel like he was trying to explain things directly to the reader through dialogue of a character speaking to another character.
It was a lot of, telling rather than showing. And I hate that phrase, like, show, don't tell, because like, I am all about, like, books just telling me what's happening and giving me all the adjectives instead of just, like, sparse prose. But yeah, I do agree with what you're saying about the prose. Like, everybody has their personal preferences when it comes to reading books. Yeah. Like, for me, for example, I really don't like Stream of Consciousness, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean that it's a bad book.
Yeah.
But with Kevin Kwan's prose, I did find it kind of stiff. Like I don't know, one good thing about his prose is I think Kevin Kwan really has a talent for describing the location.
Yeah.
Because it does, like, when he would describe, like, how the house looked or, like, the hawker market, I was like, oh, I can definitely just see it. But like, for like, the fashion brands, like we already said, it seemed a little bit excessive. And, like, the dialogue, I do agree with you. It seemed like you can... like, especially with Eleanor and all the other rich aunties, yeah. like, I feel like you could just switch their names and, like, you wouldn't know.
I mean, yeah, there definitely was, like, an auntie hive mind thing going on where they were all, like, singularly trying to crush Rachel. But at the same time, also, I distinctly remember the chapter where they introduced Astrid as, like, this high fashion person through the conversation of these, like, French aristocrats talking to each other and say, did you know that she blah, 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 blah? And... I was like...
You're like, why is this scene necessary?
Yeah, or why did this have to be a dialogue? This could just have been like a description and it would have served the same purpose.
I can see the reasoning behind it, because it's like you get so many Asians like trash talking each other. It's like, yeah. Oh, they're from mainland, they're from Taiwan, blah blah blah. But then, like, from a Western perspective, it's like, oh, they're just rich Chinese, there's yeah. like no difference. And that's why, like, in that scene you have that one, like, good
the baroness
the one good friend of Astrid, mm-hmm. like, he's like explaining to the other aristocrats, yeah. like, she's not from, like, new China money.
From,
like, she's from old money.
And then there's like, that exists,
yeah,
that's a thing. And it's like, yeah, like, Chinese people have been around, Chinese civilization's been around longer than yours.
So, like, I definitely think that scene, like, was sort of necessary to, like, provide insight, but at the same time I didn't like the way it was written.
I think it was just there was a lot of nudge nudge wink wink in the entire book, both in the dialogue and in the prose, and I felt like when it was nudge, nudge, wink, wink in the dialogue, that was a little much for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was really glad that the prologue of the book made it to the movie. Because I was worried about that. I was just like, that is, like, one of my favorite scenes in this book, because it's just so badass. Just, like, being yeah. like, it's like, you're being racist to me. I'm just going to buy this hotel. Like, I really, really like that scene. But I think the thing that the movie did well... In its adaptation, is that they made Eleanor the one who is, like,
yeah,
confronting the hotel clerk. Because in the book, it's
the aunt, it's Felicity.
Yeah, it's Felicity, who is, like, a penny-pinching rich Asian, which I found funny, because you find, like, some of these, like, old money families, like, yeah. there's, like, different personalities. There's, like, people who are just, like, I'm just gonna, like... pinch all of my pennies together, and then you have, like, the younger people who are just like, I'm just gonna toss my money. I want to, like, buy cocaine.
We can
get,
talk
like, a
about
fleet.
That because there was definitely a different, and I think this is, like, an issue even with the new money families in Asia right now, in China especially right now. It's just you have the older generation who worked and made the money, and you had the younger generation who's like spending the money. Although in this specific, like in Crazy Rich Asians, it's the second generation is also, like, kind of penny pinching, and mm-hmm. I think what that showed, like, what I got from that is, like, this need to flaunt money. It's more of, like, an overall generation thing than a family generational thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because right? all the characters here, like Nick's family, like Nick and his cousins, they're all essentially, what, like, third or fourth generation.
I think they're even Singapore. Further than that. I think it's, like, yeah. six, seven generations. Like, but they go back way, way back.
But if they're, like, 32 and 23, they're, like, they are millennials, essentially. They're, like, older millennials to, like, mid-millennials. And millennials live in a very, like, we live in the world of Facebook and Instagram and need to, like, always show, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that made sense, that, like, why, like, Eddie was so materialistic.
Yeah. I was surprised that there was a lack of social media in this book. Because, like, I mean, there's, like, phone calls and whatnot from, like, Radio One Asia. But yeah. I feel like there should have been, like, more, like, cyber-stalking.
Yeah.
Cyber-stalking and also, like, just, like, really mean Instagram. Like, I felt like it was missing that deviousness of, yeah, like, the really young, mean, rich people. Like, I expected, like, way more class in the manipulation than just, like, throwing a fish in like, the hotel.
Yeah, they were, I mean, staying in. I think that goes maybe Kevin Kwan is not as social media aware of, like, how people actually get bullied in these situations.
But also, it's, like, 2013, and they're, like, much older.
I mean, I feel like the book does a good job of explaining the plot holes, a lot of stuff in the movies. Like, exactly why Rachel didn't know anything about Nick. Because Nick's family is very private, yeah, and actually paid private people to, like, cover, like, not appear in listings or magazines.
Okay, let's talk about Nick for a second. Because I am so glad that Henry Golding played Nick, because uh-huh, he brought so much charm to, yeah, the character. Whereas, like, in the book, I just was screaming at this guy. I was like, oh my God, you're so dense. You're, like, dense as a brick. And just, like, I just felt like he was so, like, like, he felt like a Disney prince to me. Do you understand? Yeah, like,
you know what? I read his voice. This is probably, like, the pros of watching the movie before, because I read it in Henry Golding's voice, and it was a lot better for me that way, because, like, I can see why she was charmed, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're, like, I don't know what it says about me, like, you're allowed to be an idiot if you have a nice accent.
I mean, I do like the idea that Nick is, you know, he's confident and suave because he, like, he has all this money, yeah, and upbringing that, like, gives him that confidence. It's like, oh, I don't need to flaunt my money because, yeah, like, 'cause I'm, like, super rich. Or, like, I don't need to prove to anyone that, like, I'm worthy of their time because I come from this family that has been around for many, many generations. And, like, I don't know, like, that did kind of rub me the wrong way, because it does give out that message of, like, oh, I'm from a super rich old family, so therefore I have, like, better manners and pedigree.
And, okay, so in the book, he doesn't even say, like, give the excuse that, oh, Rachel's a New Yorker, like, she can handle this. Like, it's like, she'll be fine. Our family's awesome. And it's like, is your family awesome?
He has a lot of blind spots.
Yeah.
And, like, it's just more frustrating in the book because like, it's not even just, like, they, like he's, like, dense in the beginning. And then once they go to Singapore, like, he, like, finds out that things aren't going to be as smooth as he thought. Because, yeah, in the book, it's, like, he is, like, dense all the way through until, like, Rachel tells him about the bachelorette party.
Yeah.
And it's just like, how can you not pick up the signs that your family doesn't approve of Rachel? That no matter how charming she is, like, they don't consider her as, like...
Yeah. It's okay.
Like, he thinks that his grandmother will approve of Rachel, not knowing that, like, the only reason why his grandmother is letting them stay at their place is because she thinks it's a fling. She thinks, yeah, it's, like, nothing serious. And it's just like, are you really not picking up on those signals?
I mean, he is super, super doofy, I guess. and I think it's even worse because in the book, we're given insight into his thought process, which is just as doofy, just as, like, oblivious, right?
Yeah. So I do want to talk about, like, the contrast between, like, Rachel's mom and Eleanor, like, when they find out that they're going to Singapore.
Uh-huh.
Because, like, Because, like, Rachel's mom is just like, you're going to Singapore? Like, do they live in an apartment? Do they live in a house? Like, what are the sleeping arrangements? Like, this is really important. And like, her mom is, like, dead set on, Nick is going to propose to you because that's how this culture works. You don't bring a girl home in order for them to, like, just have a vacation. It's never like that.
And I love how that's juxtaposed with Alistair's mini story with Kitty Hong.
Yeah.
Right? Because, like, he's adamant of bringing her to the wedding. Everyone's like, do you realize what that means? Like, what message that will send?
And it's the exact message that he's going for, because he shows up at that wedding being like, oh, we're engaged.
Yeah.
Like, so you get the differences, because, like, Nick's original plan is just like, oh, it's going to be like a fantastic summer vacation. He has, like, no intention of proposing to Rachel until, like, after Colin and Araminta's wedding.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I feel like in the movie it was, like, very, like, dead set on him and being like, oh, I'm bringing her home.
This is the statement.
Yeah, this is the statement, which made more sense.
Yeah. I want to really quickly say I really liked Alistair more in the book than the movie.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because he was like a sweet boy in the book. It's like sweet, oblivious boy.
I actually really liked, this might be an unpopular opinion, but I really liked Eddie as a character.
As a character, yes.
Yeah, as a person. Character. As a person, no. I would slap him, like, slap him around, being like, oh, my God, like, get away from my face.
So, yeah, I think this is the, like I've mentioned before, the downfall of, like, the negative side of watching the movie first. Because, like, I could not separate Eddie, the character in the book, and Ronnie Chang's portrayal of him. But I think Ronnie did such a great portrayal of him that, like, actually enhanced the comedy of those segments for me.
Yeah. I remember when I read the first book, I just, like, Eddie was one of my favorite characters because he was
so bad.
He was, I was like, man, this guy is insufferable. Like, he's, like, super misogynistic. Like, his poor wife, like, he dictates what she wears and, like, how his children have to behave. It's, well, like, the very typical, like, I am the Asian male, like, I am, like, the patriarch of this family, and you need to be subservient to me, which is a very toxic idea. Yeah. But because, like, the way he, like, wielded that toxic personality, it was just so funny.
Not even that, but, like, he is, if there is the proof of this is satire, he is satire. Because he is, you know, petulant, he blames everyone else for his problems, he takes credit for everyone else's, like, he takes credit for, like, things that weren't his. Like, he was yelling at his wife to change her dress because it looks drab, and who would want that? Like, it's not fashion. And then the photographer came and says that is, like, the it look for the season. And he's like, oh, it's my idea.
Yeah, like, he's just like, why aren't you wearing, like, your big shiny jewelries? And she's like, well, like, these jewelries, like, this is, like, for next season. Yeah. Like, it's not even out yet. And then, like, as soon as the photographer comes in, he's like, oh, like, go change into those lovely emerald earrings that you were going to put on. And it's just, like, I just loved Eddie because he was just over the top, and you're not meant to like him, which makes him so likable as a reader. Whereas, like, I feel like with the other people in the Young and the Shang and the Xian's, family, like, they weren't as petulant enough for me. Like, I feel like,
aunties are pretty petulant.
I feel like for it to, like, really push the satire, they, like, Kevin Kwan should have, like, made it even more ridiculous. Because, like, when I was reading it, I'm like, this is just, like, you know, this is just Dragon Moms. Like, I feel like in order for it to be more ridiculous, it would have
there was that
satire.
One scene where they were like, they had got, like, a hot stock tip and started, like, calling their brokers.
I mean, that part was funny. Like, I would admit that was funny.
But you were talking about the reactions of the moms.
Yeah. I mean, with, like, with Eleanor, like, I don't know. Like, I did not like her in the book, to be honest.
I didn't, like, I feel like, yeah, like, her in the book,
she seemed so paranoid and hysterical, and
it was very one-dimensional, too. It wasn't very, like, I guess there was an attempt at adding some nuance or some, like, some empathy to her character towards the end, but it just didn't feel earned, I guess.
Like the thing is, like, there are dragon moms, there are mothers who are very controlling of their children, who are very nosy, and, you know, but ultimately I think it does come from a place of love. It's like you want the best for your child, and you want them, like, you think that them marrying for love is, you know, it's unstable.
I think that was the thing. I didn't feel that from Eleanor's character.
No,
she was
not.
Everything was about herself and her, like, image and her plans, right?
Yeah. And there are parents like that, but I feel like there were just so many of those in the book. Like, I feel like Eleanor should have been the one character who's just like, I am doing this because I am actually worried about you.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want you to, you know, be isolated from your family. Like, this is who you are. And I just felt like that was missing from the book.
Like, she could have been the one to tell him that, like, your grandma definitely does not approve.
Yeah.
You know, like, it was just from the very first moment you meet her when she's like, oh, gosh, he's bringing by Taiwanese. But when they still thought she was of the Taiwanese Chews.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it was just like, this, I'm not sure if I like this character. I'm not sure if I'm getting the right vibes that this character should be giving.
I mean, the thing is, like, it doesn't help that in the book you get, like, you get her inner monologue.
Yeah.
So you, like when she meets Rachel for the first time, she's like, why is she giving me this orange? Like, as if, you know, as if she's like a mainland Chinese person. And, like, she's like constantly, like, criticizing Rachel in her mind. She's like, oh, why is she wearing that designer dress? Like, oh, she must be like, she must be a gold digger. Like,
how can she afford these things? She's spending Nick's money.
Yeah. So it's like, you get her inner monologue, and it's just like, I don't see any sympathy. Like, I don't see any reason to empathize with Eleanor because of that. And because
everything just seems so petty.
Yeah. And as a woman who, you know, I mean, there are definitely people who are of, like, the top 1% who are snooty as hell. But I feel like with Eleanor, like, she should have been, you know, because she comes from a family that's, like, super private and and whatnot, like, I feel like she should have been, like, more dignified, in her thoughts and like, how she reacts to things. But it's either, like, she needed to be more dignified, or she needed to be, like, straight up really ridiculous. Like, she should have, like, come up with more plans to stop Nick from proposing to Rachel.
Yeah, and they barely interact in the book.
Yeah, because she goes to China.
She goes to China for half the book. She barely talks to her son except for that one, like, breakfast scene. The potential for drama was there between both her and Rachel, and her and her son. Like, her being more upfront or dramatic, or more like...
Her story
was like, this is my secret plan to break them up. And it's very, like... I get that it's very, like, I guess, Austin-y, where it's, like, high society. Like, you have to, like, play the game to, like, make things...
You have to play the Mahjong game.
Yeah. Well, there wasn't even any Mahjong. But, yeah, you have to play the politics so that things happen, but you don't get blamed for it.
Okay, see, right? Like, I don't come from a rich family, but even my family has, like, it's like, you need to play the game to get what you want. I feel like every Asian family has that game mindset, and I didn't, and, like, for rich people, they should have, like, magnetized that by, like, 20.
Yeah,
like,
the game was pretty basic that they were playing.
Like, I expected at least a confrontation scene where, like, she is with Rachel. Like, Eleanor is with Rachel, and she's like, how much? Like, how much money can I give you to, like...
Yeah.
Or, like, I just feel like it was missing that, like, one-on-one scene. Because I don't think there was a one-on-one scene with Eleanor and Rachel. Except for the confrontation scene with, like, the grandmother.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, but that's just the thing. Like, Rachel in this book is such a passive character. Like, things just keep happening to her, and even in the end, she is saved.
She's saved by Nick's money.
Yeah,
Nick's money solves everything. It, like, see, that was okay. We're jumping to the ending, but. When I was reading this when the hardcover came out, I didn't know, like, the second book hadn't come out yet. It was announced, but I didn't know, like, what was going to happen. And I reached the end, and I was like, wait, that can't be the ending. So I, like, went back, and I was like, I was like, they're just in a bar. There's like no resolution with like Eleanor. There's and like Rachel's just like, you're from a different world. We can never reconcile, whatever. But then Nick brings Rachel's mother from Cupertino, and it's just like, the reason why Rachel doesn't go to meet who she thinks is her father,
her fake dad,
is because Nick had enough money to like fly Rachel's mom over. And it's like if this is supposed to be a satire about like rich people and how like money is terrible, pretty much, like if that was the message, then like that ending just it doesn't fit in with like the morality that should have been what was the theme of this book?
Brings me to my thing, like, what is, because like talk about the movie, it very clearly can see what the themes are, right? It's, you know, Asian versus Asian American identity, Western exceptionalism versus Eastern collectivism, like the different values clashing. Like, I didn't like the book is, I mean, to me, it was fun to read about how, like, take a glimpse in the lives of the uber rich. But in terms of, like, what we're supposed to be taking out of this, I guess that's why people pitch it as a breezy summer read, because it's just, you know, it's just like a soap opera. You read through it, and I don't know if the book is going to stick with me as much as the movie did.
No. I think my main issue with the book, and, like, the ending is definitely at the top of, like, the list, but for me, like, when I watch soap operas, when I watch K-dramas, like, things just bubble up to like, a boiling point, and it just explodes. And you think, how are they going to fix this? And it there is, like, some, like, resolution, and that resolution is earned. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, with Crazy Rich Asians, the book, I just felt like I never reached that. Like, it never really bubbled over. Like, it just felt like it was, like, simmering at the same level. Like, I felt like there was really not that much buildup to the scene where the grandmother and Eleanor confront Nick and stops him from proposing to Rachel. I it just seemed very like there was buildup, but I just felt like it wasn't big enough.
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I definitely felt like the last act was kind of
it just deflated.
It didn't end on a note where I was like, okay, we're like, I have to read the next book. Right.
I mean, I did read the next book. Like, I read China Rich Girlfriend because I was so curious what was going to happen, like, to this couple, because it was just like, well, like, Eleanor doesn't approve. His grandmother doesn't approve. Nick is like, I'm just not going to use any of my family's money. We're just going to live our lives in New York. And I'm like, there's no way that his family is just going to let that go. So I read the second book, and it was even more frustrating because I didn't get the answers that I wanted.
We can talk about the second book in the future. Let's go back to... Okay, so...
I know one... it seems to me that the general public's favorite character happens to be Astrid and not Rachel.
Well, because Astrid's story seems like it has so much more stakes than Rachel's story. If I'm perfectly honest, like, Astrid actually had to, like, her character changes, right? As opposed to Rachel, who kind of largely stays the same, I feel like.
Yeah. I mean, like, it could also be the fact that Astrid is married and there is this image of, like, of having a perfect family. And if she does divorce Michael, there's, like, a lot of consequences to that.
I guess that's the thing. Like, I feel like Astrid's story, while maybe the most interesting plot thread in the book, is... And this is, again, comparing to the movie.
No, like, this is inevitable.
I definitely liked her character more in the movie than in the book, even though we know more about the situation in the book.
See, I have negatives for both portrayals of Astrid in both the book and in the movie. In the movie, I think Astrid is portrayed as too perfect. Because, like, in the beginning of the movie, it's like, oh, Astrid graduated at the top of her class, and she's, like, you know, the nicest, most kind-hearted person in the world. Whereas in the book, I kind of like the fact that she was an absent mother. Mm. Like, she's like, oh, she's, you know, she loves her kid, obviously, but she's also one of those moms who, like, leaves her kid with the nanny and, like, flies to Paris for, like, half the year.
Yeah, and I like that her relationship with Michael is more, like, explained, like, Michael's frustrations. I'm not sure how I feel about the whole fake affair thing. That seems a little too, like, it's very soap opera-y to me.
I felt like the fake affair thing was just too much. Like, it convoluted the entire storyline, I think. I'm really glad that they cut Charlie Wu from the movie, because I feel like that just would have been way too much. Especially with what's going on in the book, because it's like, Charlie Wu is, like, actively trying... I mean, he's
still in love with her.
He's still in love with Astrid, but he's, like, actively trying to have Astrid, like, retain her marriage. Mm-hmm. Like, he wants her to have a happy marriage with Michael. And that's, like, why, in the end, he, like, buys up his company. And
I mean, there's something to be said there about, like, face saving, I guess. And, like, him, like, that's kind of the Rachel story that I was missing, was, like, the... He was willing to sacrifice his happiness for hers, mm-hmm. and to save her face, right? Which is very Chinese, you know, very Asian.
I will say that I got a general sense that the male characters in this book were a lot stronger than the female characters, aside from maybe, like, Astrid, because I felt like Astrid was layered enough for me to get through the book. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, the guys, like... I felt like they were better written, and, like, for the obvious reason that Kevin Kwan is a guy.
I mean, you can definitely tell that the movie was co-written by a woman, too, right?
Like, I feel like with the guys, like, they... Like, I could understand where they were coming from. I can understand their insecurities.
Yeah.
And I can understand, like, this pressure to live up to the family name, and also, like... their own ambitions, and not feeling like they'll ever reach the holy grail of being the top 1%.
Like, with Michael, like, I totally got that he was frustrated being a part of this world that he had no interest in. He never wanted to be a part of the uber elite. His in-laws treat him like crap. Like, they treat him as an IT guy. Like, they don't understand what he does. And, like, his description of, like, not understanding what he was getting into when he married her was totally, like...
glossed over.
But, like, I mean, totally, I understand that. But it was glossed over by the fact that he was assumed to be an adulterer the entire book.
Yeah.
Which, like, it turns this, like, kind of more sympathetic, flawed, like, but, like, strongling guy into an antagonist, which I feel like it would have been stronger if they just didn't have the fake affair. It was just... the simmering, like,
yeah,
kind of
it was
resentment.
Just like the struggle, yeah, and, like, the resentment. And it would have been nice if Michael had a scene with Rachel, because they're both coming from like the same place. And I really I really wish that there was a chapter where, like, he sees Rachel struggling and he tells her, like, get out while you can, because this is, like, you think you can handle it, but you can't. Like, I felt like that would have been a more powerful...
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah, and it's funny because there's two mirrors to Rachel in this story, right? There's Michael, who is someone who's already in and in too deep. And then there's Kitty, who is literally what everyone fears Rachel is.
Rachel is, right? Yeah. I really... really liked Kitty as well.
You just like all the terrible people.
I really like... Okay, the thing is, like, I am all for flawed characters, but, like, flawed characters have to be written in a way where the writing isn't flawed. Do you understand what I mean? Like, it means, like, even terrible people, like, you need to understand their mindset. You need to understand, like, their ambitions, their flaws. And I just felt like Eddie and Kitty, like, you knew exactly who they were. And... There is, like, I don't know, that, like, there is, like, such an ease to the way that Kevin Kwan wrote those characters. Yeah. Whereas, like, with all the other characters that are supposed to be, like, sympathetic, empathetic, like, I felt like it didn't quite get me to like them enough, right, or hate them enough. Because, honestly, I should have hated Eleanor by the way that she was portrayed in this book. Because she is petty, she is... invading her son and Rachel's privacy. She's almost, like, really hysterical in the way that she goes about, like, trying to trying to dig for dirt on Rachel, because I don't think she tries hard enough to rip those two lovers apart. And
well, he thinks like they think, and again, it goes back to them having like pretty basic plans for like supposed like rich schemers, right?
Yeah,
like the mean girls plot to like break them up is to tell Rachel that we had a three-way when we were kids.
Yeah, I guess that is a plan that Eleanor had. Like, she tried to like throw
his exes at her, right?
Yeah, but I felt like she should have coached those girls more. Like, I felt like those girls like didn't do enough to create enough damage. I've met some really manipulative people in my life, and like, and it's just like, man, like, should have gotten like way dirtier. Like, I wanted like I felt like the claws came out. But like no one like lunged. like I wanted to see blood in this book, and I didn't get it.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I did like about the book was just how we got to spend more times with the characters, like the whole cast. Because there's a lot of characters in this book, there's a whole family tree in like the beginning of the book.
Yeah,
and you meet almost every single one of those, including Nick's dad, who doesn't make an appearance in the movie. But
I loved Nick's dad, by the way. I just like loved his like he's just so tired of like high society. He's like, I just want to fish in Sydney. Like that's all I want in my life. And I just loved how he's just like blasé about everything. He's just like it's like Rachel's fine. She's a good girl.
Yeah.
Whatevs. I don't understand why you're like going through all of this this crap for her. But
it is true, the guys all seem to be pretty chill, while the girls are written as very
very catty. Yeah. Very I don't know how to say this in like a nice way, but like it really, the female characters seemed so flat to me.
Mm.
And it seemed like they were so obsessed with men and money, and yeah. It's just like I wish the one character I felt like didn't revolve around men and money was Sophie.
Mm.
And like I liked Sophie right away, but there was so little of her.
Yeah, so she is Colin's sister, right?
Yes.
And Astrid's cousin, who takes like who's there to like take care of Rachel during that basketball party.
Yeah, and like she's like
a doctor.
Like
she's a surgeon, right?
Yeah. She's a surgeon. She's a tomboy. Like, she doesn't wear any makeup.
I mean, if anything, this book kind of glorifies the medical profession, because all the doctors seem to be pretty cool people.
Yeah.
Like, there's the good grandfather, James Young, who, you know, was part of the underground during the World War II. There's Eddie's dad, who is just, he just wants to, you know, play tennis and, you know, have people drive him around.
I did like the fact where, like, when they're explaining how like the top 1% works, it's like, oh, when you're growing up, like these are the three schools that you are supposed to go to. Like, you're supposed to go to Bible study. You're supposed to have tutors come and train you in every subject. You have to learn at least like three instruments for college. And if you are really smart, you go to the National University in Singapore. If you aren't good enough for that, you go to Oxford or Cambridge. And if you're not good enough for that, you go to an American college.
They go to Australia.
Yeah. Or you go to Australia and then you go to American college. And like...
And even American college is like...
Stanford isn't good
Eleanor
enough.
Eleanor Turner knows about Stanford. Like, dude.
And then for the girls, like you... It's like you go through... There are three professions that are acceptable. Medicine... law, and if you're like really dumb, business. And I thought that was so funny, because I'm like, business being like the quote-unquote like not good enough field, like you weren't smart enough, whatever.
I mean, there's the joke running that, like, you know, economics is the most basic bachelor's degree you can get while keeping your Asian parents happy. It's because it has to do with business.
I mean, Rachel has a PhD, and it's like not good enough for the parents, and like that was pretty funny. But yeah, like one of the main complaints I've heard about the book and also the movie was the lack of representation of South Asians and Southeast Asians, and how the top 1%, like they are the top 1% because they abuse their power on these minority groups in Singapore. And like for the movie, I can excuse it because it is a movie. There's such like limited
It's very narrow slice of society. But you also brought up a really important point when we were talking about this before we recorded, where there were opportunities to insert powerful brown people.
Yeah, because they freaking exist. Yeah. Like in the book,
there are sultanas. There are like Thai princes. There are like maharajas.
Yeah,
like
they're in the
Colin's,
book.
Like Colin and Nick's like college buddy from Oxford is a Turkish aristocrat.
Yeah,
right.
And like in the book, they like you see like really rich, powerful like Indians and Thais and Malaysians. Like you see them at like these functions, but you also see maids and nannies who are like Filipinos, Indonesians, and also like you see like French maids and whatnot. And like I wish there was a little bit more of that power play in the book, but like. It was enough for me to like get the, I guess, like the darker side to this.
I think this is something, if this book became a TV series instead of a movie, we would have had more space to like discuss those things, I feel like.
Yeah. Because like the whole reason why like Singapore had this like real estate boom is because there isn't like fair wage amongst the workers who do the construction, and most likely they are people who are from the Philippines and like more like from like more minority groups in Singapore, and like you catch glimpses of that, like catch glimpses of classism, colorism, but it really wasn't the right book to explore it because it's a breezy read.
There's definitely a lot of, especially like through the Michael character, they could have explained. Like, Singapore has a really crazy housing system. So I did a study trip to Singapore when I was in business school. Like, we did a tour. We, you know, went to, like, of both government and business offices. And the way they do housing is basically every person gets a one-time, like, mortgage loan from the government to subsidize a house. So, like, and each building, like, each housing complex is, they control the percentage of the demographics. Right, like each building has to be X percent Chinese, X percent Malay, X percent Indian, X percent other, right? And that is to make sure that there are no enclaves. But it's just like, because it is an autocratic government, there's a lot of control. There's a lot of like things that are intriguing, effed up, and like could have been covered if this was a book about class.
Yeah, and like, right. And like, also like, Rachel is an economics professor. Like, I felt like she should have known more about Singapore.
Oh, definitely.
I felt like she, like, I mean, we are seeing Singapore through her eyes, but I just felt like she should have known more as an economics professor.
She should have
asked more questions.
Asked more questions or wanted to be like, oh, I want to go check out the banks. I want to go check out like the financial centers and like.
Yeah, or like really.
Or like, go to university. She's a professor, so.
She has a PhD in this stuff. Like,
I mean, here's
really?
The thing. Like, she has a PhD, but she's probably still like a junior professor. Well, I mean, the movie they said she was tenured.
Yeah, she's tenured.
But like most professors, especially that young, don't have a whole summer to spend.
No, but it's explained in the book though. Like they taught throughout other breaks,
right?
So that's how they got like that 10-week break. Whereas like in the movie, you're just like, there's no way that professors can take 10 weeks off.
In the movie, it's spring break.
Yeah, there's no way that would happen. Like no way. And like it's really funny because I graduated from NYU and I was just like, there's no way a professor that young could get tenure. Like I have professors who are like in their 50s who were still aiming for tenure.
She's
like,
that good, I did find, so I definitely thought it was funny so there's a scene where the Shaw patriarch wakes up from a 6-year coma and like gets mad at everyone for being so like extravagant.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And he said that his granddaughter Nadine, who is one of the mean girls, like she looks like a prostitute from Geylang, which
it wasn't Nadine. It was
Francesca.
Francesca,
yeah. And then basically I have an interesting story about that area because for some reason when I went on my aforementioned school trip, the school booked us in the hotel right on that district. every night to walk to public transit to go to wherever we wanted to go, we had to walk through the red light district.
Oh, that's yeah. That's pretty funny.
It's the part of Singapore they don't want you to see, the government.
Yeah. Okay, we were talking about, like, what is the theme of this book? And I guess, like, another theme is, like, marriages within like, rich families. And the price that they have to pay in order to be in that class. And, like, how much pressure there is to be perfect and please your parents and to continue this legacy. I think that that is the theme in this book.
Yeah, and we've seen these themes in other Western fiction too. I mean, a lot of Jane Austen is about that. A lot of like Downton Abbey is pretty much that.
Right? Oh yeah, this is like the this is like the Singaporean Downton Abbey. Only like add in like a couple of soap opera tropes into it, and you get Crazy Rich Asians. I thought it was really funny how, like, when the Singaporean high society, they learn that Nick is bringing a girl to the wedding, they're just like, oh, is she a Taiwanese tornado? Is she going to just suck him dry of like his funds? And then they're like, oh no, she's an American born Chinese. Like, oh, like how, like everyone knows that ABCs are like Chinese peasants who fled because like they couldn't make a fortune, and they're like pretty much second generation peasants. Like that's the mindset of these people who, like, you know, who are expecting Rachel to come to
their
society.
That part kind of hurt me a little bit.
it's supposed to be like disgusting, and then they find out that she was born in mainland China,
which is like the worst possible Chinese.
They're just like, oh, she was born in mainland China. She's not even American. And I thought that was really, like, I thought that was really funny because like, they are pretty much putting labels on Rachel. They're dictating if she's Asian enough, if she's, like, good enough. And
there's a hierarchy of, like, okay.
There's a hierarchy of Asians.
Like, Taiwanese better than ABC, apparently. Better than mainland China. But not as good as...
And also, it's like she's American. It's not like she's from England or Australia. Yeah. Although there was a comment about Australians in the book, being descended from criminals.
They're just written to be the worst, but not like in a lovable way, like Eddie.
Right? Yeah. Like I was saying, like you need to write characters in a way where they're flawed, but. But, like, you understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, when it comes from, like, the aunties and from Eleanor's mouth, it just seems mean. Like, just petty for, like, no real reason except for you being snooty and snobby.
I feel like it's not even, like if someone said that to me in real life, it would really hurt.
Yeah.
Because I know it's coming from, like, an actual person. But, like, in the book, when I was reading all of the all of these insults, I was like... Who the fuck cares? Like this, like these ladies are super shallow anyway.
Yeah,
I mean, why would you care about their opinions?
As a Chinese person, like I did recognize the stereotypes that they were giving, like different Chinese people. And there was a part where they were saying like they knew that Kitty Pong wasn't actually Taiwanese because
her
accent.
She's from like a different.
She's from northern China, which has like a harsher accent, and then but not a cutesy one like Taiwanese. Like our accent's kind of cutesy. That is true. Like Taiwanese Mandarin is kind of like the valley accent of Mandarin, for those of you who didn't know. Okay, like going back to just the way he writes female characters, that reminds me of just like, I guess the chapter that I dislike the most.
Oh my God, I know which chapter you're talking about, but go right ahead.
Just the one where Rachel describes how Nick was the first Asian guy she ever actually liked.
I lost my shit when I read that chat. I like completely forgot about it the second time I read it, because like in the first time I read it, I feel like I like it didn't just stay with me. And then I think the reason why it didn't stick with me was back in 2013.
Yeah.
And I had just moved to LA, and in New York I never really faced that kind of, like, that entitlement of misogynistic, toxic Asian men. I felt like I never really encountered that before.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I've encountered it, but not so much. But like once
not in a very like concentrated, intense way.
Yeah. And then I moved to LA, and there's like there's a much more concentrated Asian American population here.
Yeah,
and like it was a culture shock. Like I didn't think that there was so much, vile opinions about Asian women dating white men.
I mean, what I got out of that was these past few years, we've been exposed to a lot more internet discourse and more understanding of what the arguments are on this specific topic. And reading that chapter, it was like the author was making Rachel be one of those girls, quote unquote, right? That the internet hates.
Yeah, like the Asian girl who says, oh, I don't date Asian guys.
Yeah, because they're not good enough or they're like, I mean, her specific reason was because they judge me.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which I think is a valid point. But at the same time, like other Asian women I've met who've said, oh, I don't date Asian guys, they have been like super shallow. And it's always been about like looks or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But the way he wrote Rachel's prejudice against Asian guys, it really rubbed me the wrong way. Because I feel like a normal person wouldn't be like, oh, I've had bad experiences with Asian guys, so I'm going to write them all off as like terrible people.
Yeah,
like that rarely happens.
One of her examples was, oh, I've dated like an Asian banking bro. And it's like, well, you dated a banking bro.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the fact that he's Asian. I mean, like maybe a little bit, but at the same time, like as an Asian woman, I've definitely been like in that position where an Asian guy is like judging me, like scanning me from head to toe, mm-hmm. like seeing like how much I'm worth and like seeing like and trying to and when they talk to me, it's like, oh, like which family are you from? Like, are you rich? Like there's a lot more.
Where did you meet these guys? I feel like I don't know people like that here, but maybe that's sure. Just my blind spot being a dude who never has to like go through that.
I've met these people from like childhood to like my adult life, my 20s. When I was younger, it was mostly because like my parents wanted to set me up.
Right.
And, you know, like my family isn't rich, but I've gone to like a lot of business dinners for my dad. And it's always
like a political type.
Yeah,
of
like a political type of thing. Same thing with weddings. Like for the longest time, I hated going to Asian weddings because it was just a lot of grilling. It was like the
like what school you went to, what's your major?
Yeah, it is like the best place to set your children up. So I kid you not. So they ask you like, oh, what school did you go to? Like, what's your major? Actually, they don't even ask that until they ask me like, oh, what schools did your parents go to?
Really?
Yeah. And like, of course, like with my mother and father, they like went to really, really nice schools in Korea. So it's like immediately they jump on it and they're like, what school did you go to? And what's your major? And like, it's like, what car does your father drive? And and you really get like those shitty people in the mix when you go to like political settings like that. But honestly, like most people aren't like that. Like it's a very specific subgroup of people.
Yeah. And I feel like her character, like he characterized her as growing up, like she grew up, like she spent high school and her adolescence in Cupertino, which is like those schools are 80% Asian. Like you meet Asians of all sorts in those schools.
She also lived in 11 different states.
Yeah.
Like she probably met like a whole like very, very different breeds of Asians.
I think he was getting his Asian stereotypes mixed up because, like, if she was someone who grew up in, like, let's say, Indiana, where there were no Asians at all, and she grew up being the only Asian around, then, like, I can buy that characterization just a little bit more than, like, someone who grew up in a very diverse area, like, in the very, like, open childhood, right?
And I feel like, I mean, it also depends on, like, what neighborhood you lived in, because there are definitely, like, neighborhoods where there are children of immigrants and... Mm. And they're not so much about like status and money. It's,
yeah.
It's mostly about, I mean, at most, it's like, what school did you go to? What's your occupation?
Yeah.
And it's mostly about like, it's about then it's like, oh, can this person provide for my daughter's future or like my son's?
Right.
Like, can they raise the children without like any conflicts?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like Asian, like the whole like Asian marriage and like raising children, it's rooted in a lot of,
yeah,
of like patriarchy. And you see that in the book. Like, you see how Eddie treats, mm-hmm, Fiona. You see how marriages and decisions are made by men in the family, and mm-hmm, how women are expected to
fall in line,
yeah, to give up their careers after like 3 years of practice. And like, that is like the filial thing to do. And, and it's just like, yeah, that's true in a sense, but at the same time, like,
yeah,
like
that actually made me like kind of not like her as a character.
Oh no, I immediately disliked Rachel after I read that scene.
Yeah.
Like in my second read, I was like, oh, all sympathy for this character is gone. It is completely gone. And I don't like the narrative of like Nick being the exception.
Mm.
It's like, oh, like this is the kind of Asian guy you should date, or just like, oh, you haven't met the right Asian guy yet to, mm-hmm, change your mind. And it's like, it's just like such a,
it's a little lazy.
It's a gross way,
yeah,
of like having, I don't know. It just read as gross to me. And there were a couple of language issues in the book that rubbed me the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know the title is Crazy Rich Asians, and to me, like, I read it as, like, extremely rich Asians. Like, crazy is,
yeah,
the word, is the replacement word for extreme. And, but at the same time, like, it has, like, that tone of, like, oh, like, really ridiculous, ridiculously.
I mean, I'm sure that's what he was going for, too, the double meaning.
But I don't like the way that the word crazy is used to describe like ridiculous people,
mm,
because like the word crazy, it like I think it's a little bit ableist because it's like a derogatory term.
Only a little bit. I think it is
for like mentally ill people. And it wasn't just the word crazy, which showed up a lot in the book. I was like, okay, like how many times, mm, am I gonna read the word crazy, like when people are yelling at each other saying, mm-hmm, like you're crazy. Like, I felt like it was repetitive, first off. And also, like, I didn't like the way that they described, there's this one line where Rachel says, oh, like, oh, I moved around a lot when I was a kid. We were like gypsies. And I'm like, that's a racial slur. You shouldn't be using that. And also, like, there's another line where you read from Eddie's perspective, and he's like, oh, like, I have this watch, but it isn't this brand. I have, yeah, this yacht, but it can only, like, fit 10 people for brunch.
I don't have a mirror in my closet.
Yeah, and then it goes to his kids, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, his kids are well-behaved, well-educated,
right,
photogenic. And then in parentheses, he says, oh, but isn't the youngest child a bit autistic?
Yeah.
And like, I that rubbed me the wrong way, like the wrongest way possible, because both of my brothers are autistic. My boyfriend is autistic. And it's like, that's just not how you describe people. And it's not like his son has been diagnosed with autism either. So it felt like it was wrong.
Do you think it was in character, though?
That's why I could let it slide a little.
Yeah.
But like, I just felt like it was unnecessary.
It's more on the author, I feel like, than
I also don't like the word, like, OCD. Like, that was used to, like, I think Eddie does have OCD just by, like,
his mannerisms.
His mannerisms, yeah, the way he thinks, and how many steps ahead he is.
The way he focuses on, like, a single task.
There's a line where Rachel describes Nick as OCD. It's like, oh, you have OCD habits. And I'm like, don't use OCD in, like, a casual way. Like I said, I had some minor issues with some of the language in this book, and I felt like the editor should have called out on some of them. But
like, it didn't necessarily add to the story, right?
Or it really startled me from the story. It really distracted me.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I felt about that chapter.
With the Asian guy
just took me out of it. I was like,
I was just like, it doesn't really fit in with the character. I don't think it's really a commentary on Asian American culture, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. I don't know if it was like, was it projection or was it like, I don't know.
I'm sure there are Asian girls who think that way. Yeah. But I just felt like it was not in character for Rachel.
And yeah.
Like, if you were going to give that kind of prejudice to someone, it should have gone to someone who's more unlikable or something. I don't know. It's just, like,
yeah,
we've been like criticizing this book nonstop, but I guess good things, like overall good things about the book. I liked how you have so many Asian men. Like, mm-hmm. How rare is that?
I like how so many Asian characters in
general.
Period.
Yeah, right? Like, and then you have like variety of like where they're from, mm-hmm. And it's set in Singapore. It's not really a country that a lot of people know about. Yeah. A lot of people know about China and Japan, but Singapore is like one of those like smaller Asian countries that they've only heard about, like the chewing gum law.
Yeah, you only think about how it literally is the financial capital of the Southeast Asia.
Yeah, and like you, and through the exposition, you learn about colonialism. Like, mm-hmm. You learn about how it affected the wealthy Chinese immigrants
how they value British culture above all else.
And how that has been passed down through the generations.
I mean, Eleanor refuses to eat congee when she's in China for breakfast. I'm like, what? You're not really Chinese.
and it does, like, educate Westerners who are unfamiliar with, like, the hierarchy of Asians and, like, the prejudices.
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like this might be a good book for this might be a good book for white people.
I mean, it is.
It is empirically.
Like even Kevin Kwan himself said, his biggest audience has turned out to be white women, right? And it is a very like it's not a trashy read. I wouldn't call it that.
No, it's not trashy.
There isn't like I wish it was more trashy, but
like there isn't like a 3-chapter long sex scene like.
I think beach read is the right word, meaning that it's kind of light and fluffy, right? Something that you don't have to like.
Yeah, and like that doesn't mean that it's not literature, because I think even beach reads and like very fluffy romance novels, they are like serious pieces of work. it's just like you're supposed to have fun with it. I don't think you're supposed to like go into a deep dive of like analyzing the economics of Singapore.
But this is a book club, so that's what we do.
I mean, yeah, this is our jobs.
But yeah, I mean, I feel like I am interested in what happens to the character, so I will read the second and third books, because apparently the second book doesn't resolve much about Rachel. Apparently.
The second book, like, there's a lot more character arc jumping, and to me, like, it didn't really answer a lot of my questions, and... Like, I feel like I have to read the third book for that conclusion.
Right. So, I want to ask you about your thoughts between book wedding and movie wedding.
I remember when I watched the movie wedding, and it was, like, an early screener, and we're supposed to, like, give notes and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I said the wedding scene was too long and a little bit too sappy. But apparently a lot of people cried during the wedding scene.
So in the movie, right?
In the movie.
I've seen two different, very distinct reactions. Some theaters were silent and really like taking it all in and getting emotional. Mm-hmm. And other theaters just burst out laughing. And I think that is pretty much been a 50-50 split on those two reactions.
The second time I went to go see it, I went with my white friends. Mm-hmm. And... one of them was like tearing up at the wedding scene. It's like, oh, it's true love. And I'm just like, maybe I have like a black heart because.
No, see, here's the thing. Like, it's not the wedding itself because of the ridiculous. It's the looks between Colin, Araminta, and Nick and Rachel that are like very well done. The wedding itself is ridiculous. And I think.
In the book, though, like the wedding is. 10 times more ridiculous because you have like
the reception,
you have the Cirque reception, Cirque du Soleil, and like the food is just so weird, like the just like the over the topness of the book wedding. Like, I actually laughed a lot during the book wedding scenes in the book. So I was like, are they getting married in Disneyland or something? This is, like, so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it, like, brought, like, a smile to my face because I'm like, only deliriously rich people would be able to, like, spend $40 million on. And then there's, like, that one scene where... like, Araminta is walking down the aisle, and she's like, I wonder what dress Astrid is wearing. And then she notices that Astrid wore the same dress to, like, a different wedding. She's like, that bitch!
Yeah.
She couldn't even bother to wear, like, a new dress for me. And then at the at the reception ball, like, she's just like, oh, I can't wait for the couture gown, because everybody's, like, dressed in, like, couture. And like, Astrid shows up in, like, a vintage...
A
yeah. Right. And like, Araminta's like, I cannot believe she didn't, like...
Why did
I even have this wedding? And I thought that was so funny, because it, like it just pretty much summarizes, like, what the wedding was. Like, the wedding wasn't for Colin Koo and Araminta. It was just for their family to show off how wealthy they are.
Yeah.
And it was just all about image, which is pretty much what all of these families are about. It's all about, like, this power play of who's better And they do it in different ways too. Like the Young family, they're always complaining about their poverty. Like who's poorer, whose children are, like, not living up to the name, and, like, it's just, like, humble bragging in that family. And then you have, like, other families that are like, let's spend all of the money to, like, show off that we are better than everybody else. And,
well, those are typically the new money families, right?
Which is, like, Araminta's family.
Araminta's family. And Paiklin's family.
Oh yeah, Paiklin.
D'Oro.
Like, we forgot to talk about Paiklin.
I don't know how I felt about her and her father's role in the story being, like, Lord Dumps, pretty much.
Yeah. Very much of them, like going out and seeking information.
Yeah.
I did prefer Awkwafina and Ken Jeong's performances as those characters.
But I did like how it filled in her family more, because in the book, the two twin girls are actually her brother's children.
Yeah.
But then in the movie, she doesn't have an older brother, right?
No.
So those are her sisters then? Or, I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I, like, Paiklin, I did like her in the book. I thought she was, like, despite being, like, super rich, she was down to earth, and
well, she was characterized as someone very competent, right? She was, like, business development.
Yeah, she was the smartest of the family.
Yeah.
Do have some Goodreads comments in our forums.
We have Danielle, who asked about our thoughts about the Astrid changes in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think we covered that earlier. Mariko reads that, have you read the articles that Kevin Kwan is wanted in Singapore for draft evasion?
I've seen articles, and I know Singapore readjusted their punishments last year, so I think they are stricter this time around, and they are really buckling down on draft evaders. So, Kevin Kwan has not released a statement on that, so we won't know his side of the story until it comes out.
I mean, I'd believe it.
I had some friends who are like 3 years older than me, 2 years older than me, because they had to serve in the military before they went to university abroad. So I know that, like, that is a thing that you have to do in order to, like, get an exit visa.
In our book discussion thread, David, who is a booktuber, posted his review of the book. He called it the perfect summer read. And he was very much in the camp that this is a romance novel.
I agree.
Says, very plot lines, Mean Girls aesthetic, a will they won't they plot that snakes over three large books, so it's the best romance novel. Was there a will they won't they won't they plot, though? I feel like it was a will they when will they.
Yeah, I think it was more of like, when will they.
Yeah, I don't think it was ever seriously in doubt. There was, like, some tension, but it was, I feel like the stakes of the romance wasn't big. Mm-hmm. I guess if there was a major critique for me, it was just like the main characters just weren't, I don't even say interesting enough, like, active enough, I guess. Like,
I felt like there wasn't enough action from the characters.
Yeah.
And I felt like Rachel, like, she Like, I feel like Rachel in the book, things were happening to her. And whereas, like, in the movie, like, things were still happening to her. But, like, I felt like there was more of a bigger reaction to it.
I feel like, and yeah, this is where I will say that I did enjoy the movie more. I enjoyed reading the book, but I enjoyed the movie more for how it centered the action on Rachel. And maybe that's the benefit of it being a movie. And I kind of wished this was actually turned into a TV series where you can, like, spend time on different storylines and build, you know, build more perspectives. But in terms of the movie, like, what I liked is Rachel takes ownership of her agents. Like, the climax isn't Rachel is saved because Nick flies her mom out. The climax is her confrontation directly with Eleanor.
Yeah, that Mahjong scene. Yeah. That is, like, one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Which the book was missing. And I'm really glad that they added that in.
Yeah, I like really love that line when she's just like, so when you're, like, with your grandkids and, mm-hmm. you know, you're just hanging out in your garden, just remember that happened because of me. Like, it happened because of this poor immigrant American girl. So peace out. Like, I really, really like that scene. And I also really love the scene where, like, the proposal where, like, he opens the ring, like, opens the ring box, and it's Eleanor's ring.
And that was a plot point that was added in. It wasn't in the book. And it also, like, I mean, it's telegraphed a mile away, but it's still very, like, it's Eleanor accepting Rachel for a reason that I can get behind.
Yeah, because, right? Like, in the book, it, like, briefly mentions how, like, Eleanor says, like, I know how it feels to be the daughter who will never be good enough for the family. Like, I'm from a Sung family, and I was, like, you know, I'm from a rich family, and I was still not good enough.
Yeah.
So, like, it was there in the book,
and
but...
she talked about all her sacrifices, which... in the book, just it rang a little false based on her actions throughout the book.
And her thoughts, too, because you read her inner thoughts.
Yeah, whereas in the movie, like, there's that scene on the staircase where she, like, straight up tells Rachel, you will never be good enough.
Yeah.
Where she lays out, like, this is why I think you'll never be good enough, which you never get in the book.
I mean, like I like that confrontation scene because... because, like, Rachel says, oh, you don't approve of me because I didn't go to a fancy boarding school and I come from a poor family. And Eleanor's response is, no, because you're American. Yeah. Like, you only care about, like, pursuing your passion. It's like you don't know how much sweat and blood and tears went into building this family and the success. So, like, obviously you're not, like, since you don't understand that, then there's no way you can continue the legacy of what we built. So like, I felt like the book was missing that, but this is a great thing about adaptations. You like, you have a second chance, right?
I did like the so this is the last thing I'll say about movie versus book, but so in the movie there's the scene where Eleanor confronts Rachel on the staircase. And Eleanor's explaining how she wasn't the first choice or the second choice, that Philip married her out of love, and that her mother-in-law didn't accept her. And then Rachel goes, but she came around, right? And Eleanor shoots her a look. In the book, it's Rachel that shoots Nick that look when Nick tells her, but my family loves you. And she's like, are you kidding me?
It's like, oh, Nick, you dense piece of... you're a teddy bear filled with bricks, just stuffed with cement.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I said it before. I'm just so glad that Henry Golding played Nick.
Yeah.
Because, Nick really came off as, like, a Disney prince in my eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, like, charming, suave, good looking. Not much else.
The professor of history. So what does that say about liberal arts professors? I don't know.
I mean, I know, like, he's a history professor, but he certainly did not act like a history professor. Mm. I, like, forgot about that most of the time. I'm just like, oh, right, like, he teaches history.
And on that note, I think I think that'll do it for our discussion of Crazy Rich Asians by Kevin Kwan. If you have anything to add to anything we have said or have any thoughts of your own to add, please let us know on our Goodreads forums. You can find the Goodreads Books and Boba group by going to goodreads.com and searching Books and Boba. Definitely looking forward to what you all think about both the book and the movie.
Yes, and our September book club pick is Number One Chinese Restaurant by Lillian Lee.
I'm so excited to read this.
This was actually Marvin's pick. Marvin really wanted to read this book, and I said, okay, because we haven't really read a new book this year. Most of it has been paperback.
Yeah.
So.
And it's about a restaurant I'm pretty sure I've been to when I was in D.C., so I'm pretty excited to check it out. Yeah, that's your book for September. We'll be talking about that at the end of the month, so please join in. And that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Reba, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts. We had many of them on this book. Maybe sometime in the future we'll do a follow-up once we finish reading the trilogy. Maybe we can...
Yeah.
Talk about that. Coming up next week, we'll be sharing Reba's discussion with book club members Catherine and Alice Fan Cheng about the movie adaptation of To All the Boys I've Loved Before, so watch out for that. Thanks a lot for listening to Books and Boba. You can subscribe to us on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to the Potluck Podcast Collective for letting us be a part of their group. The Collective is a group of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from our community. If you want to listen to more discussion about Asian August, please check out the latest episode of They Call Us Bruce. Like we mentioned, the latest episode is a live interview with John Cho, the star of Searching, that they recorded after a live screening. Definitely check that out. It's a great conversation, and John Cho is super, super
charismatic,
reflective, and he's just all around great dude. This podcast was also recorded at the Potluck Podcast Studio, located within the Office of Visual Communications. Visual Communications, of course, is the awesome organization that supports Asian American film and media artists. They're the awesome people behind the Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival and programs such as the Armed with the Camera Fellowship. And speaking of the LA Film Festival, if you do have a short film or feature film that you'd like to submit to an awesome Asian American Film Festival, VC is currently taking submissions for the 2019 edition of the Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival. So get your films in. And on that note,
keep reading.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye.